Good morning, everybody. Welcome. We have just a few announcements this morning.
Good morning, everybody, and I'm hogging up the announcement space today. First announcement, this is from Suzelle Lynch and Church West. They would like to let us know that there is a Peter Mayer concert there, the lovely man who wrote our hymn, Blue Boat Home. He is going to be at Church West on November 21st. Tickets are about $20 a piece. They're selling them through their website, and there's an added perk. They are putting on the website, which church are you from? So if you are from a UU church, they are asking which one. They're going to do shout-outs during the concert and recognize. And unofficially, we're competing a little. So myself and Skylar over at the Waukesha Church and Suzelle, we would all like to see our congregation have the most yays when they ask which congregation. Hint, hint, hint. So anyway, if you like Peter Mayer, please buy some tickets for that. You can get them online. Go to their website. Go to Church West, UU Church West website, and you can find the links for the concert. Next thing, our Vision Quest meetings. We have spent part of the past year in appreciative inquiry sessions to search for what is our vision for who we will be as a church in 2020. And we think we've got it based on what you've said. We think we have that final vision statement. But we need your input, or this is your last chance to have input before we call this good. So we have two different nights this week to make sure that most people can come on one night or the other. Please don't come on both unless you are drawn to do so. Either Thursday or Friday, we're going to start at 6 p.m. on both nights. Very short, the piece that I am doing and the members of the Committee on Ministry are doing. We're just going to explain. We think we got it. It's based on what you said were our vision priorities. Here it is. And if you have any tweaking you want to do to the wording, this is your chance to do it. So come Thursday or come Friday, hear the 15 or 20 minute words we're going to say about what this is, where it came from, and then you can have up until, we've got the church up until 8 o'clock both nights, you can have as much time as you want to talk about any changes you want, but we think we got it, so it's good to go. If nobody shows up, we're calling it happy. Child care is potentially available, but if you need child care for that, please email me or Stephanie in the office and let us know you will need child care and which night so that we can arrange that. Third announcement, our Minister of Religious Education, Skylar Vogel, is being ordained at the Waukesha Church next Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m. You are all invited. He would love as many of us as possible. And parts of his congregation may be coming for our service next Sunday because they are not having Sunday services next week. So if you see unfamiliar faces, say hi. They may be from our Waukesha Church. Last announcement, crayons and pieces of paper. You should all have one. One piece of paper, one crayon, all the grown-ups. If you don't have one, you can get them from the ushers or you can kind of raise a hand and we'll have an usher bring you one. But make sure you got your card and your crayon. You're going to need it. I'm making you work today. That's all the announcements. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Come in. Come into this place that we make holy by our presence. Come in with your vulnerabilities and your strengths, your fears and anxieties, your loves and your hopes. For here you don't need to hide or pretend or be anything other than who you are and who you are called to be. Come into this place where we can touch and be touched, heal and be healed, forgive and be forgiven. Come into this place where your story can be told, where your truth can be known. Come into this place where the ordinary is sanctified and the human is celebrated, where compassion is expected, and even if we get it wrong, we try again and again. Come into this place because together we make it a holy place. Come and let us worship together. Please take just a moment to say hi or to introduce yourself to the people nearest you.
For the gift of this day, and for our community of spiritual nurture and compassion, we give thanks. We light this chalice as a symbol of our faith. May our many sparks meet and merge in communion of heart and soul.
Rise in body or spirit and join me in singing our first hymn, number 131. 131, Love Will Guide Us.
Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we work to surround this community with the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Christy, and I'm today's worship associate. No matter who you are, where you come from, or where you are going, you're welcome here. We welcome those who have known nothing but acceptance in their lives. We also welcome those who have known the pain of exclusion and suffered disdain for their differences. LCUUC is a UUA-recognized welcoming congregation, which means we welcome and affirm you and all people, regardless of who you love or how you live. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service. While you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. In your order of service, you'll see announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to everyone joining in. Like and follow LCUUC on Facebook or visit lcuuc.org to get ongoing information about activities, events, and services. Please take a moment now to silence the electronics you have with you today. And again, welcome. We are so pleased that you've come to celebrate and worship with us today.
One of the ways that we try to choose love in our community is by contributing to the local food pantries. And food pantries are invaluable in these tough times at helping people try to make ends meet when sometimes they just don't meet any other way. So every month we give both non-perishable food items, which we've collected, and money. So if you've brought food items today, I invite you to bring them up or have a child bring them forward. And I'd like to ask the children to stay up front for a story. And this story is a free retelling of a very traditional 2,000-year-old story called, or more than 2,000 actually, called The Shattering of the Vessels. And it gets told around this time every year in a lot of synagogues. And it's about choosing love. And it goes like this. At the beginning of time, before anything else existed, love was all there was, and it filled up everything in the whole universe. So everything was all one substance, and that substance was good. But love got bored and lonely. There was nobody to be in love with. So one day, love decided to make a world. First, it took a deep breath. Can you all take a deep breath? What's the deepest breath you can take? Take a deep breath. And let it out. Well, love practiced and took deeper and deeper breaths, and each time, love would squish itself in to take that deep breath. And finally, it squished so hard that it created darkness. It squeezed darkness out of itself because it was trying so hard to breathe that it squished itself down tight. And darkness spun out like ink out of an octopus or ink out of a squid. Darkness was all around it and thick and shiny and black, and it was beautiful. But now love couldn't see anything. It had all this black stuff all over around it. And love waved its arms and its legs around trying to get the black away, but it was everywhere. Boy, I have to do something about this, said love. It thought for a minute, and it tried to think of all the most wonderful, warm, beautiful thoughts that it could think of, which is kind of hard when you're sitting and surrounded by black, gooey stuff, but it tried. It thought harder and harder, and all of a sudden, love yelled, "I want light!" There was an explosion, and all the warm and beautiful thoughts exploded outward in 10 different directions, out through the blackness. And they shaped themselves into 10 big glowing glass balls. So like 10 big Christmas ornaments, clear glass filled with nothing but light. And each ball was filled with a big old spinning lump of pure light and pure warmth. Some of the spare good thoughts that couldn't quite fit in the glass became dust and water vapor and seeds and molecules that could form animals. And love said, "This is amazing. Look at this. Look what I made. I better create something for all this light to shine on." So it waved its arms in the dark again, and it kicked its legs through the blackness. And all of the dust and the water vapor and the molecules that had been scattered around began to form into another huge ball, much bigger. This one of dirt and water and plants and animals, and love called it the earth. And love went and got those 10 balls of light that were orbiting around the earth and tried to carry all of them. Have you ever tried to carry a bunch of bright, shiny balls all at once? What do you think happened? They broke. It's no good to try to carry 10 big, shiny glass objects all at once when you just finished building a planet. If they'd made it here in one piece, everything would have been just perfect. It would have been exactly the way love wanted it. But the balls were so fragile, and the thoughts inside were so big and so warm that as soon as love accidentally banged them together, they shattered. All the good thoughts shattered and flew out like sparks and scattered like sand and like seeds and like stars. And those sparks of the good thoughts fell everywhere on earth in tiny bits instead of the big clumps that love intended. Oh, no, said love. I'm too big. I'll never be able to find all those sparks. I have to make one more thing. So love waved its arms and kicked its feet one last time, and people appeared on the earth. They didn't know it, but they were created with one job, to find the sparks, those tiny pieces of wonderful goodness, and to bring them back together into the big clumps. When enough clumps are there, I will recreate the big glass containers to hold them, and this time I will be more careful, love said. So all of us, from the very minute we're born, we have a job. And that job is to help find love and more good and warm and wonderful things, and to bring them together with other people and things and our planet, because love's keeping track. And when we do this, we're fixing the world. Thank you for listening to my story today. Could I have my lantern bearer? Where is he? Yep. You can go on up there. And may the light and love of our chalice lead you today and every day. And I'm going to ask that you all help me in singing the children to their classrooms. The song is "For You Shall Go Out," and the words are written in your order of service. And if you all will follow the lantern bearer. The new minister was very concerned about the finances of her church, and she was determined that she was going to get more money. She wrote a long and fiery sermon dedicated to financial generosity, and she started to preach, and she preached, and she preached, and she preached, she preached. And a little girl started to get restless as the sermon dragged on, and as the preacher pounded the podium. And finally, unable to stand it a minute longer, she leaned over to her mother and said, "Mom, if we give her the money now, you think she'll let us escape?" The morning offering will now be given and received. Thank you so much for these gifts given and received for the life and the work of our community. Every service we share together, our joys and our concerns. And before the service, you're always welcome to come up to the table, silently light a candle. But during the service, we do it together. We speak aloud and we share the lighting. So would anyone who has a joy or a concern to share, please raise your hand and one of the ushers will bring you a microphone.
My name is Claire, a candle of concern for a former coworker. Her daughter tried to take her own life a few weeks ago. She's now at Rogers Memorial Hospital.
My name is Robert. A candle of joy. A friend that I work with in Haiti was successfully treated for tuberculosis and released from the hospital. And another of my coworkers there is coming to the United States for the first time.
Good morning, everybody. Scott here. I've got a very dear friend of mine who lives back in Las Vegas, where I lived for a time, and he was the guy who got me into rock climbing, which has become a huge part of my life. Apparently, I didn't know this, but last May, he had a emergency brain cancer surgery, so I just found out about that recently. He's obviously survived, but I don't know what kind of shape he's in. I'm hoping to get in touch with him. He's having a hard time with the meds and just kind of struggling with health. It's real hard, because Chris and I went out there last spring and saw him, and he was very vital. At 60 years old, he's climbing great. And to have it turn so suddenly, that's hard. So if you could have any good thoughts for Dan, that'd be much appreciated.
And we light our last candle today for all the joy and all the sorrow that maybe we haven't been able to speak aloud today, but that we still hold deeply in our hearts.
In Paul Murray's novel, Skippy Dies, there's a point where the main character, Howard, has an existential crisis. "It's just not how I expected my life would be," he said. "What did you expect?" a friend responded. Howard ponders this. "I suppose it's stupid, but I thought there'd be more of a narrative arc." But it isn't stupid at all. Though perhaps the facts of someone's life presented end to end wouldn't much resemble a narrative to the outside observer, the way people choose to tell the story of their lives to others, and most crucially to themselves, almost always does have a narrative arc. In telling the story of how you became who you are and of who you're on your way to becoming, the story itself becomes a part of who you are. In the realm of narrative psychology, a person's life story is not a Wikipedia biography of the facts and events of one's life, but rather it is the way a person integrates those facts and events internally, picks them apart, weaves them back together. That's the way to make meaning. This narrative becomes a form of identity in which the things someone chooses to include in the story and the way she tells it can both reflect and shape who she is. A life story doesn't just say what happened. It says why it was important, what it means for the person, for who they'll become, and for what will happen next. Here ends the first reading.
Who are we? What is our story? What's our definition? If you ask each of us at our core, who are you? You strip away all the who should you be and who might you be and who do you wish you were. Who are you? If you ask me, my answer would be simple. Stripped away of everything, it would be, I am a dreamer. For my sister, the answer was even simpler. I am a mommy. All the others didn't matter. Today, as we meditate, I ask you to think about one thing. Who are you? Not who should you be or who do you wish you were. But the ultimate piece of yourself that you know to be true. The simple piece. The piece that would fit on a t-shirt. Who are you? You each have a piece of paper and a crayon. We're going to do about 2 minutes of silence. Think, who are you? And then in one, two, maybe three words on that piece of paper, finish the sentence, I am. Who are you? We are going to collect these, so please do not put your name or identifying anything on this. Be honest, who are you? We'll be adding these to the list over here, and I will be reading some of them later in the service. Please do not identify yourself. But who are you? And please join me in a few moments of silence and meditate on who am I?
The second reading today is A Litany of Wholeheartedness by the Reverend Don Cooley. Reverend Cooley is the minister at the First Unitarian Church in Old Louisville. Because there have been times when shame has crushed our ability to be wholehearted, we let go of who we ought to be and we embrace who we are. Because we have not always had the courage to be imperfect, we let go of who we ought to be and embrace who we are. Because we have struggled to have compassion for ourselves and for others, we let go of who we ought to be and embrace who we are. Because we've been afraid of our own vulnerability, we let go of who we ought to be and embrace who we are. Because sometimes we are too scared to live authentically, we embrace who we are. Because we want to be wholehearted people, confident in our worthiness and in our belonging, we let go of who we ought to be and embrace who we are. Here ends the second reading. Please stand in body or spirit and join us in singing number 128, For All That Is Our Life.
I actually started working on this sermon while I was in one of my rare moods to watch television. And the Who song had just come on for the crime drama, and I heard this, "Who are you?" you know, shrieking at me. I went, wow, that'd be a great title for a sermon. And it started to fall together there. So who are you? Sounds like a very, very basic question. It's a question very much based on context and tone. If I ask the person I've just found crawling through my dining room window at 2 a.m., "Who are you?" they pretty well understand I'm not asking for some deep, meaningful conversation. "Who are you?" "Well, I'm Steve, and I'll be your burglar for tonight." It's that simple. Who are you? It can mean anything from, "Why are you talking to me?" You know, "Who are you?" to, "Why are you so different from your usual?" Who are you? I don't even know you anymore. To, "Who do you work for?" or, "Who are your people?" Who are you again? Excuse me, who are you? And it can mean, "Who are you? Define yourself. Tell me your story. Read me your labels." And that's the version we're talking about today. Each of us has a story which is shaped by our culture and our history. And that isn't really too obvious when we're very tiny. Kindergarten for most of us is the first time it starts to be obvious. We enter kindergarten or first grade or wherever we'd left the house for the first time for periods of time. And our story becomes public property. I don't know about you all, but when I hit kindergarten, one of the first things the teachers did was write your name in nice big letters. And you got to walk around for that whole first day or two with your entire chest blazoning your name up there. So, you know, you flapped when you walked because you had this big piece of paper on a cord. Some teachers hung them on desks or put them on your cubby. Your name, what's in a name? Am I Amy or am I Amira Betchheim? William or Billy? Oli or Ollie? Nisea, Ahmed, Fung Lee Kim, Kelly Running Bear, Bobby Jim, Mary Catherine O'Shaughnessy, Sunshine Galadriel. Before we even put our heads in the door, just by looking at our names, our most basic labels, the teacher had some idea of our story. White or black or Asian, rich or poor, Jewish, Irish, Catholic, born in the late 60s and raised in a teepee in a commune. I bet most of you could pick out from those names which one was which. Names are our first label. They begin our story when we can't even speak. They tell others about our privilege, who we come from, who our people are, what their level of education was. Did they spell the name right? Or will we go through life as Oprah instead of the Orpah that her mother had intended? In 2003, there was a study, and some researchers wrote a paper called "Are Emily and Greg More Employable Than Lakeisha and Jamal?" A field experiment on labor market discrimination. They published it through the American National Bureau of Economic Research. It's actually pretty dry. But the results were unsettling. Forbes magazine printed some of the less dry results. Applicants with white-sounding names are 50% more likely to get called for an initial interview than applicants with black-sounding names. Applicants with white names send resumes, about 10 resumes for every callback. Applicants with black names, it's 15 to 20 resumes for the same result. And the interesting thing was, one of the researchers, Marianne Bertrand, said, "We're not claiming that there's discrimination. This is not deliberate. This isn't necessarily an issue of racism. This is subconscious, and it's important to teach people in charge of hiring that this bias is there." In other words, no one's trying to discriminate. They're going on the label. It's triggering something in them. So much weight on a naming word. So as we get older, we add chapters to our story. Each one builds on the ones that came before, beginning with that name. According to anthropologist Harold Isaacs and many others, humans are tribal and social animals. We don't do well on our own. We need our tribe. We look for the patterns and behaviors and appearance that tell us who is ours, who is like us. And this is where subconscious bias creeps in for every one of us. Our ancestors, our family, our cultural history all determine the early chapters. What do we learn? How do we learn it? Are we loud or quiet? What do we eat? What do we wear? What do we get laughed at for? What makes our people stand up and applaud? What do we worship? Or is worship foolish? Can we argue? Can we search for truth, or is truth handed to us? What are the rules for life? And depending on how close our story is to the average or the norm for our region, we begin to gain labels beyond our name and our family name, and we begin to give these labels a weight and a value. So at meditation, I ask you to write a simple label for yourself. If you had to claim one major piece, the label you can't omit in defining yourself, the one that begins with "I am." And again, please do not put your name or identifiers on these. I'm going to ask that Christy and Sue, if you would help, please pass your cards down to the ends of rows. You're welcome to turn them over if you like. They're going to be picking them up. Events happen in our lives one after the other. And in our minds, we arrange them into that narrative arc that we talked about a few minutes ago. Interpreted through our culture and our belief, we select labels for ourselves and we accept labels based on this story. And I love this example. My friend Gail, she has 5 dresses and 2 pairs of shoes to her name. She has no other clothes. She has no car, no television, no computer, no makeup, no jewelry. She dropped out of school after 8th grade. She got married at 19 and has 5 children. Here in Heartland, she would be the poorest of the poor, uneducated, badly dressed. But the fun part is that Gail's Amish. She lives in Adams County, Ohio. And among her own people, she's considered extremely wealthy. She lives on one of the richest farms. She drives the best buggy in town. And she is spectacularly well-dressed. Her bonnets have tucks. And she is truly considered by the other young ladies to be the fashion plate to emulate. It's all about context. Our stories only work in context. So here's a fun one. What do you all call the thing that we drink water out of in the back hall? What is it? It's a bubbler. It's not a water fountain. What's the thing you push to put your groceries in? Cart? It's a buggy. These are our contexts. These are the little things that tell us that some of these differences are there. So how does this tie into spirituality? I'm glad you asked that. There's a Philosophy Now article. Is the Buddhist no-self doctrine compatible with pursuing nirvana? That's complex sounding. And it's by Katie Javino, and she says this, Buddhists argue that it is only conventionally, not ultimately true that we are persons. Bear with me for a minute. I'm dragging you through some deep water. That is that our concept of ourselves as persons does not correspond with reality. A person should be mentioned as existing only in designation, but not in reality, not in substance. So the Buddhists say that we consider ourselves persons because through experience, we learn that we are made up of 5 aspects. The body, our feelings, our perceptions, our volitions, and our consciousness. But the word person is merely a label, merely a convenient designator for the fiction we accept when we believe a person is something over and above the component parts. Buddhists therefore accept what the Buddhist scholar Mark Sideritz calls a meteorological reductionism about persons. They claim that the parts exist, but the whole does not. Let me break that down a little bit, because that was a little heady. I had to read it about 4 times to get a real grab on it there. So your physical body exists. You exist. You're sitting here. I can poke you with something. Your hormone reactions, which we call emotions, happen. You get happy, you get sad, you get scared. You get input about the world through your physical senses. That works, that's physical. You have the will or the volition to act on other physical pieces of the world. I want to pick this up, so I did. And there is self-realization that these things are happening. I know I picked it up, I'm that good. But don't mistake the story, don't mistake the label for reality. There's no such thing as smart, for example. There's only the story of what you did and its perception. So when we tested monkeys with standardized testing designed for children, they screwed up one question really badly. And the question was, where do you sleep? They all failed. Where are you supposed to sleep? All the children of the same age got it. They all knew you slept in a house, in a bed, in a bedroom. They got that part. Guess what the monkey said? And they all said it. They all knew you slept in a tree. They all knew that, and every one of them got their answer marked wrong. Because they're stupid, right? Children are smart. Monkeys are stupid. They all knew you slept in a tree. There's no such thing as smart. There's only context. The story of what you did and its perception. Rich and poor are contextual. Gail's quite rich in her own community, but here in Heartland, she'd be dirt poor. Healthy is a relational term. My friend with CP is extremely healthy. She just happens to have CP. Your job title, it explains functions you might perform, but it does not identify you. It is merely a label. All of it is illusion. Words to define yourself relationally within your tribe. A story to explain how are you standing here. But the marvelous thing about your story is that you are the only one who can tell it. You're the only one who can choose which labels are correct and how you'll wear them. Most of us are great about that with the ones we've picked. We do a really fine job of saying things like, well, when I was in high school, I was a cashier. And in college, I was a server. Now I'm a doctor. We have no problem with that. We cast off those labels and feel no attachment to them. We are wearing the correct one. Now I'm a... We don't keep telling people, I'm a cashier, 20 years after we finished our PhD or our master's degree and changed jobs. We recognize when to discard a word that no longer suits us in some cases. But words that others have hung on us, we don't do as well with, especially negative words. Have you ever had somebody tell you, I'm a loser, I'm a failure? We accept those as a tribe. We do better at hanging on to those words that aren't such great words. We also hang on to some odd ones, words about religion. I'm a Catholic, 30 years after the last time you've been in a Catholic church. Okay. You get to do that. These are words and labels that we let color our story for years, even when they don't mean anything to us anymore, even when they're not attached to us anymore. Search your heart. If a label isn't sticking anymore, throw it away. If it's as distant from you as that job that you worked when you were in high school, peel the label off and pitch it. It's not relevant. It can be difficult to really grasp and use this idea of duality. The idea that our story and our labels can profoundly influence our physical reality. They're the source of prejudice. They're the source of all kinds of privilege. And yet they are not real, not in and of themselves. You have a story. You have ways you identify yourself that go with it. And, big and, you alone get to decide which story and which words are the right ones. Every person, from you to a felon, to a young mother in the inner city, to a young boy on a farm, to Donald Trump, has the power to create a true story of who they are. I'm not going to do all of these. Here's who some of you are. I am a mother. I am trying to help. I am compassion. I am an intellectual, physical, and spiritual explorer. I am an older animal. I am a peace seeker. I am about others. I am a defender of the natural world. I am a giver. I am a leader. A thinker. A survivor. A mother. A visionary. A healer. A provider of hospitality. A hoper. I am trying to help. I am a family provider. I am a disappointed person. I am a caregiver. I am a lover of living things. I am serious. I am grace and courage. I am a wife first and adventurous. These are marvelous. These are who we are. These are how we identify. I am a conscious life force, a seeker, a soul learning and growing, a friend, a bridge between people. I'm a spirit becoming. I am a dad that is really good at the farmer dance. I am a peacemaker. I am a co-creator. I am a skeptic. These are who we are, and I've got, and Christy is putting them together there. I'm actually going to put that in our social hall for a week or so to remind us of who we are. We are called to honor one another's true stories, to recognize this power to create and to accept each person for who they are. Doesn't mean we don't see their actions, but that we hear and welcome who they are, even if we do not or cannot welcome what they do. Tell your story. Select your labels and discard the ones that don't fit. Listen and honor others' stories and the labels they wear, and do not presume to give them ones because you like them better. No words can tell the truth of your being. You are greater than the words. Your existence at this point in time is the only possible answer to the question, who are you? Anything else is only a name card. And you are the only one who gets to choose what is written on it. Choose well. Amen. We are going to do a few minutes of a polylog today. So if anyone has comments they would like to make, please raise your hand and an usher will bring you a microphone.
This is Chris. In 1968, I was an unwed mother, but about 10 years later, I was a single parent. So it kind of tells you things change in society, and it went from negative to kind of positive.
Hi, it's Barb. In 1968, I was a hippie. In 1972, I was a college student. When I got out of college, I didn't have any idea of what to do, so I fell into cooking and became a chef. And that is has been a real, there's a spiritual side to it for many years. And now I'm looking forward, and I'm not going to be that someday, not too far in the distant future. And it feels really scary.
Yeah.
But it's just part of the journey.
Eric Moraine. Amy, thanks for bringing this question into a larger audience. This is the ultimate question. Krishnamurti says this is the only question. Everything else is a corollary of this one. Who are you? And I want to put in a quick plug for the Sangha, which meets on Thursday evenings, to explore this question. So if Amy has your curiosity up, please come and share that on Thursday evenings. This is what we jump into every week.
Hi, my name is Ray, and I'd like to just comment. I was writing too furiously to get my slip turned in here. But maybe I want to thank you for this topic and just mention to you that in our environmental justice class, which starts today, we're going to be exploring this a little bit further as in our first class. But actually what I wrote down was I'm a biological manifestation of the stardust that is this earth in search of truth.
Hi, I'm Lisa. Amy, thank you for bringing the question up. I think in the U.S. it's really easy that people define themselves by the jobs that they do, and they see that label and try to fit into that stereotype and mold. And I don't see that as much. People that I've met from Europe and things, it's a job to them. It's what they do. It's not who they are, yeah. And it's good to keep that in mind. Thank you.
I'm Dan, and a few services ago I played a song that I wrote called Capitalism. And this is one of the this is one of the topics that I kind of, you know, tongue in cheek in the song. The lyric says, "Don't call me a communist, I'm not a socialist. I'm just a God-fearing, tree-hugging humanist." And so if you really think about how that would fit with labels, it doesn't.
Right. It may tell the truth, but there's no way to label it.
Hi, my name is Chandra. Analogous to this question is actually another question. Yeah. Who am I is a meditation metaphor used in Vedanta knowledge to connect with the universal self. If you keep saying, who am I, all the layers will drop off, and then you get in touch with the absolute.
This is Lynn. I've been thinking a lot about actually more of Chandra's question, who am I, in terms of meditation and mindfulness. And it's an awesome question, and thank you for bringing that up. And I think labels serve us well sometimes, but often don't serve us well. And not only the labels we give ourselves, but the labels we give others and things and experiences and all that, you know. So human beings are so complex.
Anyone else? Thank you all for participating today in our polylog. Would you all please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our closing hymn this week, number 1008, 1008, When Our Heart Is in a Holy Place, from the Teal Hymnal. If that is which is most holy lies within the human person, and if the greatest power in the world shines flickering and uncertain from each individual heart, then it's easy to see the value of human associations dedicated to nurturing the light. For the power of good in any one of us at times will waver, but when a group together is dedicated to nurturing good, it is rare for the light to grow dim in all at the same moment. So borrow courage, borrow wisdom from one another. Warm us and keep us until we're together again. Peace, and may it be so.
Combination of all those things. Don't forget the basket.